The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast, the first of the new year. My name's Sam Leith, I'm the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm going to be joined by two writers and critics who are Dorian Lynskey, the author of The Ministry of Truth, a biography of George Orwell's 1984, and DJ Taylor, whose books include On 1984, a biography of George Orwell's masterpiece, so two 1984ists. And it's appropriate this week because George Orwell has at long last come out of copyright, and we're going to see the market flooded with all sorts of Orwelliana and hopefully cheap but rigorous editions of his work. Welcome both. I suppose to start, say, you've both written about 1984. That's the thing most people think of when they think of Orwell, first of all. Is that kind of the core of his work? I mean, you know, what's the important thing about Orwell these days?
I think that the problem is, and I'm sure Dorian would agree with that, with this one, is that we now tend to see Orwell's career, given that he died so quickly after the completion of 1984, we do tend to see it as, you know, a form of teleology. You start with 1984 and then you work backwards, and all the paving stones which led along the path to 1984 then spring up. But the other thing about Orwell, of course, is that if he died, say, well, at any time up until, you know, including the Second World War, I think we would have regarded him as an interesting minor writer. You know, there's a whole heap of stuff, thousands and thousands of words, six or seven volumes that precede Animal Farm, which was the book that really made his reputation. And one of the wonderful things about him, and I've recently been rediscovering this, you know, with current work on Orwell, is that it all shapes up. Unlike many a major writer, inverted commas, Homer never nods with Orwell. You can pick up a tiny fragment of his journalism written, say, at the height of the Blitz, typed straight onto a typewriter, and there's always something there. There's always something interesting. He's never just doing it for the money, as, say, Evelyn Waugh did. You know, if you read some of Evelyn Waugh's early journalism, it's pretty dreadful. And there are letters from his agent apologising to magazine editors that, I'm afraid Evelyn wasn't really, you know, on the case. Orwell never did that. Everything was serious, even the tiny review for Tribune that he wasn't getting paid for. So I always find that there's so much more to him there than that sort of forced march through the early work that leads to 1984.
But I think maybe what makes him interesting, I suppose, is the fact that he had these abiding obsessions, all of which feed into 1984 in some way. Like, he didn't really understand cinema or theatre, but as a freelance journalist, and I can identify, you know, if somebody asks you to be the cinema or theatre reviewer of a small magazine for any money at all, you go, yes, you know, I'll give it a shot. But what makes those reviews worth reading, even though he's usually wrong about film and has real no interest in kind of like, say, screen acting or where you put the camera, is he sort of going, well, what does this say about sort of totalitarianism? What does this say about England? What does this say about cruelty? And so it's the fact that he has these ideas that he's sort of exploring in all of these different arenas, and almost without 1984 to sort of make sense of them, it might make sort of less sense. It was like, well, why does he keep bringing these ideas into sometimes reviews where they don't really belong? And I think it is because he's constantly working through something. And that's why 1984, it would have been such a sort of tragedy, even if he'd lived to become the man that wrote Animal Farm, if he hadn't written 1984, and a way that could weave together everything from his sort of big theories of totalitarianism to his sort of love of junk shops and the countryside, that you maybe wouldn't have the sort of the glue that really holds together what otherwise might seem like quite sort of disparate work.
What you say, Dorian, there is that suggests that there was, if not a monomania, at least there were a small core of preoccupations that were the things he was interested in, and that was quite narrow. I mean, was he that narrow? Did he have a sort of very small palette?
I don't agree. I think he had a very wide palette, but I think Dorian's point about 1984 being the magnet that draws what might look on the surface to be quite a lot of disparate material together is a very good one. And it's also interesting how he begins, I think, to reframe elements of his early life through the perspective of what became 1984 as he goes on living it. I mean, I know, Sam, you've written about Such Were the Joys, the famous essay about his prep school experiences. And it has to be said that countless writers wrote about, you know, what had happened to them at prep school during the time of the Great War. And none of them had it quite so badly as Orwell. And there's this great debate which has been going on for years as to when he actually wrote Such Were the Joys. You know, did it precede 1984? Was it written during 1984? But whatever, on whichever side of that fence you come down, you have to accept, I think, that there's a relationship between that essay and the novel. And in whatever form, Orwell is recasting what he thought about his prep school through the point, you know, the view of a totalitarian society.
I think he had, I suppose I'll take the third way here and go that it wasn't that he had a sort of narrow range of preoccupations. I think they were quite broad, but he definitely had a firm line between things he was interested in and things he wasn't. And I think there's a really nice quote from, I think, Anthony Pohl, going that it just in conversation with Orwell, he said, if a subject came up that didn't interest him, he would refuse it like a horse refusing a sugar lump. And it was just a sort of, there was a cutoff, and you can see this in sort of Orwell's writing, that there's just certain things where he's like, I'm not interested in this, and yet I'm going to bring it round to what does interest me. And somehow then sometimes you get, therefore, something much more interesting. So when he's writing about Dali, he's not an art critic. He's not particularly interested in visual art, but he's fascinated by the personality of the artist and whether being an appalling person invalidates the art, which makes his essay on Dali this incredibly enduring and relevant essay on how we decide to assess the art versus the morality of the artist. And it's sort of far more enduring than perhaps if it was just a wonderful bit of art criticism.
It's exactly the same, I think, with what he had to say about sport. Not in the least interested about sport, except as he once said he had a kind of hopeless love affair with cricket when he was at school. So when he gets to write a review, you know, the review of Edmund Blunden's Cricket Country, written during the Second World War, and it's not really the review has nothing really to do with the sport. It tests out Orwell's ideas about democracy as reflected through sport. And so he says that whatever you may say about cricket, it's not actually an upper class thing. It's a democratic sport. It takes at least 23 people to play it on a cricket pitch, and there has to be some sort of social interaction. And he says that golf is the snobbish sport, golf is the class sport that's taking over vast acreages of the British countryside. So again, it's cricket refracted through his own particular political ideological focus.
There's a bit of a sort of chicken and egg question here, which is, you know, you're talking about how these sort of ideological and political preoccupations informed his worldview. But when you're talking about, for instance, Such Were the Days, you know, that question of how he was seeing it through a totalitarian lens, is it, and there is a question, and I know, David, when I spoke to you about Such Were the Days, you said, actually, most of what he wrote in that was kind of bollocks, that he exaggerated massively to fit it into this preoccupation. Is it that somehow his views on totalitarianism came out of a horrible prep school childhood? Or did he retcon the childhood to fit it into his views of totalitarianism? I'm curious really about what it was that turned sort of Eric Blair into George Orwell, where these preoccupations came from.
I mean, it's a very strange one, because it's not one or the other. And so, for example, if you read Burmese Days, there's a description of the persecution of a man in Burma, and it's, he's describing it, and this is before, Orwell was writing this before he was particularly interested in sort of Soviet history, and long before he was sort of thinking about 1984. And yet it sounds exactly like the way that somebody would be treated in 1984, and you know, the way that sort of Goldstein or in the book, or Trotsky in real life. And it just seems like this was obviously something that he had observed in Burma, this way of the way that people lived. There was a form of doublethink there, the way that certain people would be sort of cruelly defamed in a sort of, you know, version of the two-minute hate. And so this was obviously something he had genuinely observed, and that you almost think, well, it almost reads as if he'd sort of retconned it, but he hadn't. And so with Such Were the Joys, you've got this strange mixture of, I think, some genuine memories and a genuine feeling of sort of fear. And I've interviewed like a punk musician, and he said, well, the first thing you protest against before you protest against the government is your parents and your school. And so it's very easy to see that experience of a public school, I think, of a brutalizing public school through a political lens. And so that's why David said this can never really be resolved, because it's obviously being written in around the same time as 1984. So it's sort of colored by that. It doesn't mean everything in there is a lie, but it affects the language that he uses. And then you hear these weird echoes of that language in 1984, where I think there's a kind of, I think it was one of the bits in the draft that didn't make it into the final novel, but he's describing one of the people in the Ministry of Love, Parsons, I think, as like a schoolboy awaiting a caning.
In this exactly the same way as that O'Brien is described as either like a priest or a schoolmaster, isn't he? Exactly the same. I think the point you were making just there about Burmese days is a good one, because I've always noticed the number of times in his writings where Orwell specifically sets down and addresses incidents from his early life is relatively small. And in fact, his friends remember that he would never really talk about Burma or Paris. He would just sort of say conventional things like, of course, you know, in Paris one travels on the metro to such and such and so forth. But what he does do, he had this unerring eye for sort of seeing a significant incident of vast symbolic metaphorical significance that he could then use 20 years later. I mean, for example, he says hardly anything about his time in Burma, but he does remember the incident on the ship, you know, where he sees a fellow passenger kicking a coolie. And he does remember seeing the quartermaster stealing the dessert, you know, and carrying it back to his quarters. And you get the feeling that he kind of hoarded these things in his consciousness for future use, that he knew even at the time that they would come in useful for some sort of subsequent exploration when he came down to write seriously about these things.
Well, yeah, because he spent one night in his life in a cell, and he remembered a broken toilet, and the broken toilet appears in the cell in 1984, and it's
which of course was exactly the sort of thing he would have remembered because of this extraordinary fastidiousness, you know, that encouraged Sutherland to write a whole book about Orwell's sense of smell and his kind of pathological urges that drew him there. Yeah.
Do you think there's a sense in which his importance as a sort of ideological seer or an analyst of totalitarianism or an allegorist of political situations has kind of eclipsed and scanted his literary qualities? Does he get sort of overlooked qua writer because he's seen so much as a prophet?
The problem is it's much worse than that, I think, actually, Sam. He's become a kind of, you know, to use the technical term, he's become a floating signifier. He can prove anything. He can be brought in to judge any situation. He is the man you go for any kind of wider political comment. But it is interesting. I mean, I've just, as you mentioned earlier in your preamble, this great tide of reissues, which is now going to overtake us, and, you know, the repackaging of Orwell, which will be conducted on a merciless scale. And I hold up my own hand because I'm involved in it myself. But it's very interesting that hardly anybody, most of the things that are being reissued, the principal reissues are 1984 and Animal Farm. And as far as I know, only two people are going to be bothered to reissue, you know, Clergyman's Daughter with notes in. For some reason, those early novels, and in fact, Alexander Larman, who writes that blog for The Critic, was on Twitter only yesterday, you know, saying, here are these four early works, which are comparatively unknown and pretty much underrated, that all have good things in them, irrespective of, you know, the building blocks in the wall of 1984. And we do, I think, you know, there are whole loads. There's loads of Orwelliana out there that we do, I think, sort of slightly overlook. And
I mean, it's tricky, I think, because he is a sort of, he is quite a limited novelist. And you have to think, like David's saying, say he dies before Animal Farm. You know, how do we assess those novels? And we probably are going to sort of say, oh, there's lots of interesting ideas, but not many sort of fully realised characters. A lot of just kind of vehicles for the author's own opinions. And so it means that they are good, but he always had this sort of weirdest fantasy that if it wasn't for war and totalitarianism and all the awful things happening around him, he would just be a proper novelist and a poet.
An aesthete. A proper aesthete.
And it's just bizarre because he didn't have that pure talent. He didn't have an art for art's sake talent. He wasn't this sort of wonderful, naturally wonderful novelist. And actually his talent was for dealing with the world around him. And he does that in those early novels as well.
But have you noticed, Dorian, how the style changes? about midway through the 1930s. He starts, I mean, Burmese Days is full of these extraordinary Rococo flourishes, trying to, you know, they're almost art for art's sake, 1890s kind of, you know, the moon like a dying, you know, this kind of thing. And it goes as far as the first part of Keep the Aspidistra Flying. I think there's a moment in the first chapter where he describes a tram as gliding like a raucous swan on a, you know, steel, that sort of thing. A raucous swan of steel. And then after that, it all calms down and he starts writing more sort of matter-of-factly and forgets all this sort of this aesthetic stuff. But I think he had a real struggle to kind of coax himself into what we regard now as the pure Orwell style.
I think the problem is that when you talk about what Orwell represents is that it's not even just based on 1984. A lot of the time it's based on a sort of misunderstanding of 1984. And I mean, I know that one of my ambitions in writing the book, and maybe David's with his as well, was really just to sort of explain how rich, you know, 1984 is, how many other things that you might need to know to fully understand sort of what he was getting at, the literary qualities of it, that I've read a lot of utopias and dystopias that are essentially essays in which just characters just wander around explaining things to each other. That's not what 1984 is. And so there is a great deal of literary craft in that there is a love story, and a very unusual one, is that there's a kind of spy plot that isn't quite sort of carried through. But yeah, there's swapped briefcases and a kind of a shocking betrayal. It's like he did really make quite a lot of effort to make it a readable book, you know, as of course, even more so with Animal Farm. You know, there was enormous effort to make these ideas that kind of animated him that he thought were really important, to make them accessible to a reader in a way that a lot of his contemporaries just didn't bother. It was simply like, here are your idea, here are my ideas, eat your greens, the sort of mid-period H.G. Wells approach.
So one question I want to ask you, though, is, I mean, you can see him. There were two reasons, I think, why it took so long to write. One, because he wasn't well. The other one, because he had constantly trying to fit new things that he'd thought about and new aspects of this totalitarian world into the book. But he, even so, he still thought, I mean, Orwell typically never liked what he'd written once it was finished. He still thought he'd made a mess of it, that it wasn't quite right, that it could have been better. What sort of book do you think it would have been, Dorian, if he'd lived another 2 or 3 years, if he'd had time to properly do it in the way that he thought that he wanted to do? Would it have differed substantially? Given that he spent 6 years on it, you know, from conception to publication, which is a long, long time for Orwell, what do you think would have happened had he...
The main criticism I can think that he made of himself, of the book, was that he sort of agreed with Julian Simons that... who was like a friend who also reviewed the book quite critically. He said he agreed that the kind of the final bit in The Ministry of Love was a bit too melodramatic. And I think so probably he would have tried to... but then, of course, that's one of the things that kind of shocks and engages readers so much. So I don't know whether it would have made it better, but I think he would have tried to lower the melodrama there. But then the other bit, I suppose, that most readers would go, you know, this could be improved, is the huge section of Goldstein's book. Is there a way of incorporating that information into the text in a kind of more sort of, in a smoother, more digestible way?
Though it's quite interesting, though, isn't it, in what Goldstein tells us about the characters, because I had my first suspicions of Julia when she falls asleep listening to it. And I thought, you know, a real rebel, someone who was real up for the revolution, would have managed to stay awake listening to the masterpiece of Goldstein.
I mean, I like that bit, but I think... But then I don't know if Orwell would have wanted to change that, because from what I can understand, that was almost the first bit of the book that he wrote, because he thought it was so important. So I think maybe that what Orwell wanted to change is not what a reader might think that he wanted to change.
Do you think Animal Farm holds up? I mean, I was just remembering the notorious rejection that Animal Farm got, which more or less said, you know, what you, Dorian, were saying, other utopias have. I mean, I think it said something like, it's just a series of ideas about communist Russia, Stalin's Russia, and it's, you know, dull as ditch water. Was that just massively off beam, do you think?
Well, I can say my daughter, my eldest daughter, who's 14, has just been studying it. So I was able to make myself useful and go, oh, you might want to mention the Kronstadt Rebellion. get an edge on the others. She found it enthralling. She found it really moving, really pacey, really complex. And that is a book that is far more complex than you think when you first read it. I mean, the resonance of some of the kind of language, the very dry humour. There's a lot going on in there. And so I think that, I mean, that I would say is something that you could say holds up even better. I think it's far closer to perfection than 1984. Like, what makes 1984 so interesting is that it's kind of thorny and messy, whereas Animal Farm is somebody going, this is what I want to do, sitting down 3 months later, he's done it.
The other thing too, and the great thing about Animal Farm, I find, and this is from the biographical point of view, is how much it's actually a disguised love letter, I think, to the Oxfordshire of Orwell's childhood. Because if you start looking at the farm and working out how it functions, you realize it's almost entirely unmechanised. You know, Farmer Jones and his wife have the lithograph of Queen Victoria up in the front room. Even the papers the pigs start taking in are kind of Great War, you know, the Daily Mirror and John Bull and this kind of thing. So, in other words, the atmosphere of the book is at least 30, if not 40 years behind the time when it's, you know, it comes to an end in 1943 time. So it's a very disguised autobiography as well, I think. No, I agree with you. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece of work, which I would have thought, you know, most modern teenagers could find something to approve of in.
Well, that's the basic thing, that it's moving and it's enthralling, even if you don't know the allegories. And that's what's incredible, that you can sort of scrutinise it and go, well, this is clearly a reference to this pact or this conference or this rebellion. And yet, the point, people are still moved when Boxer dies. They don't think, they're not moved by the allegory for the betrayal of the sort of proletariat. They're moved because a horse dies. And to be able to operate on those two levels, I can't think of anything else that sort of does that.
No, and in fact, Orwell was delighted, because one of the first readers was his friend Anthony Pohl's nephew, Ferdinand Mount, who was then a boy of six, and who said, you know, Orwell was delighted when he said that Ferdy had liked it because it had no long words in it. You know, and as a six-year-old, he could just blast straight through. So
I hadn't known that. Fantastic detail. David, that point you make, I want to pick up on the nostalgia for the sort of rural England. I mean, there are sort of, there's a strand in Orwell to do with the love of, you know, with a sort of patriotism, a love of, you know, old pubs and junk shops and all that, that seems ordinarily now we'd associate it with a conservative point of view. I mean, to what extent was Orwell a conservative? Because obviously he was a man of the left.
Oh, so obviously a man of the left, but I tend to agree. I can't remember who. Cyril Connolly said that he was steeped in the worst illusions of 1910, and I think you have to agree to a certain extent with that. I also quite incline to the. This is apparently, it's said of him that he was a conservative in everything but politics. But then, of course, you could argue that as politics infect absolutely everything, then this is a meaningless comment. But I have noticed, you know, going through the collected works recently, how often I was reading recently his essays, his work about H.G. Wells. And the thing that he keeps on praising Wells about is his ability to convey that kind of lost Edwardian England of security and solemnity and prosperity. And he's always going back there. And it's noticeable even in Anthony Burgess's 1985, you know, Burgess's take on 1984. And one of the points that Burgess makes, which is a very good one, is how much of the imagery is rural. You know, even when something is set as an urban setting, he's always describing something to, you know, a wheat stoop pushed to one side or something like that. So in some ways, the Orwell locus classicus is back there in Henley on Thames in the early years of the 20th century.
Well, there's an amazing letter that Eileen Blair, his first wife, sent a friend just around the time that Orwell was writing The Lion and the Unicorn, which is his kind of argument for sort of socialist patriotism. And I can't remember the exact words, but she says something, goes, George has written, or Eric, I can't remember how she refers to him in this, he has written a little book about how to be a socialist, though Tory.
That's it, I remember it, yeah.
Which is so funny and really sort of sums it up. And I think he's quite, I think particularly Coming Up for Air is the really interesting book about nostalgia, where he sort of admits that there's lots of ways in which the Edwardian world was worse. And he goes, it was worse for workers and it was worse for women. And it's not that you want to go back there, he says, but what they had that we don't have is that they didn't live in fear. And I think that Orwell's nostalgia, even though obviously there's a personal dimension, hugely personal dimension to that, but I think it's sort of, I felt that it was justified in a way that if you were in right now, the time we're living in, to feel nostalgic is not reactionary. It's quite legitimate. Of course you miss a time before a pandemic. that's fine. And so sort of Orwell's nostalgia is against the backdrop of a time where most people, at least until the end of the war and the kind of post-war Labour government, but during the kind of late 30s and the war, most people would say, no, the past was better because we didn't have Hitler and Stalin and all that. And so his sort of, and Coming Up for Air is a great kind of, it's almost a great sort of defence of nostalgia as something that isn't necessarily reactionary, and that you can look back to the past and go, OK, it was worse in that way, but it was better in that way. And what he felt was that the time that he lived in was so full of kind of fear and hatred that it was dehumanising. And I think he thought there was something very human about that time.
And he makes the same point, doesn't he, writing about the early Victorian novelists, writing about Dickens and Thackeray. I mean, his point there is that in some ways this was a terrible world. It was a world before social security and proper medicine and so forth. But there was a liveliness and a vigour about it that's reflected in the fiction of the time that we don't have now. I'm very conscious of that, reading his essay about Dickens, and also Oysters and Brown Stout, that wonderful essay about Thackeray as well, written in the Tribune in the 1940s.
That issue of him being a floating signifier, I wonder, he's become, you know, as you say, you know, only, I think, in the last 24 hours, the abject Josh Hawley, having had his book contract cancelled by Simon Schuster for cheering on the Capitol rioters, tweeted, you know, this could not be more Orwellian, you know, which is, has that sort of sense in which he's now available for everybody, wherever they are ideologically, to say this is Orwellian, does that sort of defang it a bit?
It's just an inevitable thing that happens. A journalist was asking me yesterday, you know, how or in what way this great tide of Orwell reissues and repackaging differs from, say, Dickens coming out of copyright or, you know, another major novelist coming out of copyright. And the difference is, of course, that we live in a world of endlessly proliferating media where there are so many new platforms for this to be exploited that it is a completely different thing. You know, there's a video game of Animal Farm launched a couple of weeks ago. There's going to be all sorts of films and adaptations and probably stage view. And there's nothing that, you know, there's nothing the estate can do about it. There's nothing that anybody can go and do about it. It's just all going to be out there, and it's going to have to be sifted and assimilated in a way that I don't think has happened with any previous major writer, simply because the media climate has changed so much.
One way of Sessions, I think, is the way that is how far back this attempt that the basically the only people, the only faction that I could tell that just decided to reject Orwell was the kind of hard left, the Stalinists. At the time, they're still doing it, the descendants of the Stalinists.
Well, I don't know if you see that there's that American socialist, John Neusinger, wrote a marvellous review, I think both your book and my book together, in something like the Socialist Review, where I think they were two of the worst books that had ever been written in the history of the world or something like that.
Amazing.
But you're right, they've never forgiven him, have they?
But apart from them, everybody else wanted to claim them. So one of the things that I came across in research was that in the 60s, you had both the Black Panthers and the John Birch Society using 1984. And so it's something that, and I realize that, you know, you really can't do anything about it. I limit myself to calling out fake quotes, because there's a lot of fake quotes that go around in kind of meme form. And I do think that if you're going to claim Orwell, you should at least claim things that he actually said.
Just as a footnote, the only journalist or commissioning editor that I've ever had dealings with who seemed suspicious of Orwell, and this is 20 years ago, was Seamus Mill, who I think uttered the words "weaselly little Trotskyite."
Well, you still get the sort of tankies on Twitter calling him a snitch.
Mm. The list, people get furious about the list, don't they?
What was the bottom line on the list?
I could never get very worked up about the list. I mean, Orwell had been asked by a friend who worked at the Foreign Office's IRD Bureau to come up with some names of people who wouldn't be suitable for writing propaganda pamphlets for free countries in Eastern Europe that were about to be swallowed up by, you know, the communist predator. And it's a mark of how dodgy the whole thing was, in that the man sitting at the desk next to Celia Kerwin, who asked Orwell to do this, was Guy Burgess. You know, that's how infiltrated the Foreign Office had been in 1940. So I can't get very worked up about the list. I don't know what Dorian thinks.
I think my sort of conclusion was that the great problem with it was that the story was shaped by information sort of leaking out in the wrong order. And that sort of in the 90s, the existence of the list was learned. I think. And then the first version that was published was the version in his notebook, which was entirely private. It was sort of very bitchy.
It was bitchy.
And sometimes inaccurate. And that for a few years, I think for about 4 or 5 years, that was the version that people thought, OK, well, he just sent this to the IRD. And then a few years later, Celia Kerman died.
And they found it upstairs, didn't they?
The actual letter was discovered. And also there are letters to, I think, to David Astor, which show his sort of process where he was going, well, look, I'm not going to send her this big baggy list of, you know, sort of personal grievances. It's really important to work out who is genuinely, who I just don't like, and who is genuinely kind of dangerous and should not be used for this specific task. And so the actual letter leaves out almost everything that people got agitated about in the late 90s.
From the private correspondence, but by
then,
yeah,
the narrative was then set up. But actually, you see the lengths he went to be like, I want to be accurate. And all the names that he didn't put on there and all the ways he tried to think, you know, and as David says, the whole point was just like, don't use these people. Not like destroy their careers. And in fact, nobody's career was adversely
nobody's contract was cancelled, were they? I mean, nobody was cancelled as a result of...
No, exactly, because it was a private sort of thing. So I think it was the way it leaked out. And I think the thing is, it's not a smoking gun, but I think it was what people that had hated Orwell for decades really needed. They were like, this is the proof that he was a McCarthyite. And of course, it was like nothing of the sort, but it's the best, it's the firmest evidence they have that Orwell was a rotter, you know, so they're going to use it.
That mention of the wartime propaganda department, so I mean, it was the only Orwell story. I went to interview George Weidenfeld before he died, and he worked in that same department. He said, oh, I worked alongside, you know, down the corridor from George Orwell. And I said, oh, God, you worked with Orwell. What was he like? And he said, oh, he was a bit of a pest. You know, I had this publishing concern, and he was constantly asking me to publish this essay of his, and I told him, you know, get bent, George, we're not doing it. I said, what was the essay? And he said, oh, it's called Politics and the English Language. And, I mean, that essay, obviously, is one of the, you know, sort of not directly anti-totalitarian or political touchstones. And I'm wondering how, particularly in light of, as you say, David, he completely changed his writing style to the plainness. That's, you know, because people sort of use one half of that essay to talk about, you know, giving substance to lies, using euphemistic language. And then they take those sort of rules and, you know, any number of hashtag am writing people will say, well, you know, Orwell's a great style guide. You have to follow Orwell's rules. His...
No, well, I think those rules can be taken too far, actually. I mean, Orwell's... The plain man idea, I think, is in some ways completely wrong, because, I mean, for good prose is like a window pane. Well, no, it isn't. I can think of loads of writers who are really excellent by my criteria who don't write prose like a window pane, and some writers that Orwell admired who wrote prose that wasn't like, who had a certain degree of opacity that you had to get through. And then there's the not using the double negative. I think he's wrong about that as well. You know, he said there's that famous sentence where he said, if you ever think the double negative is a good idea, try starting the sentence with a not unbrown dog was running over a not ungreen field, without realizing that sometimes, you know, by describing somebody as, you know, not wholly charmless, you can convey about a paragraph's worth of meaning in a few words. I think he kind of, you know, probably took that line a bit too far.
But he put a gag in at the thing is, there's a gag at the end. He goes, break any of these rules, rather than outright
barbarous. Yeah, exactly.
And so the idea that people would take it as rules, when in a sense he's sort of being tongue in cheek about these prescriptions. But could I just make a quick point about what you were saying about how Weidenfeld kept rejecting this essay? What's amazing is how much of the really important stuff that he wrote was written kind of on a random commission, like Why I Write, which is one of the most important essays. I didn't realise it was a very short-lived literary magazine, and it was meant to be a regular feature where each issue, a different writer would answer the question, Why I Write. So it wasn't like Orwell sat down to do this. He was asked to do it. And looking back on the Spanish War, the stuff that's most quoted in reference to, say, Trump or Putin or fake news or whatever, was cut out by Alex Comfort because the essay was too long. It's the most important section. I last saw it quoted in the movie Spider-Man Far From Home. because it's become that important as a point about organised lying. And it didn't even appear in print until his lifetime. And so many of these things that we think as very important essays were in magazines that you've never heard of. They were, they weren't published in his lifetime, or they're only taken on by somebody after they've been rejected by somebody else. And I find that so fascinating, the gap between how we venerate these essays like those, like Politics in the English Language, and actually the really kind of tough time he had as a freelancer.
Piecemeal, ready-made. As a footnote, by the way, to that, did you know that he's quoted in Soul about the new Disney movie that started streaming on Boxing Day, and they get the quote wrong. It's from Keep the Aspergister Flying, and somebody says, as Orwell said, public education is the last rattling of the swill bucket. And in fact, it was advertising was the last rattling of the swill bucket. So I mean, interesting that should have been...
I did say, yes, I forgot about that.
And it's wrong, yeah. It's inaccurate, you know.
Shame on Soul, we should cancel it.
Otherwise, a good film, I thought.
And I like the idea that Orwell was one of the advisors, wasn't he? Like in The Other World, to teach people how to be human. I think he'd quite like that.
Do you think his sort of moral clairvoyance kind of holds up? I mean, he's held as this sort of great, you know, anti-totalitarian and, you know, the last word on how totalitarianism works. Was he as reliable in all respects, or were there aspects in which you just go, ah, Christ, you got that wrong?
It's amazing how many of the warnings in 1984 turn out to have been right. I mean, Peter Davison once sent me an extensive list of what Orwell got right in 1984, and it even included things like deforestation and, you know, degradation of the environment. I mean, there's a lot for the environmentalist, I think, in there. And Orwell also predicted the national lottery. There was another thing I think he got right in there. But no, I mean, obviously he's like any weekly journalist. You know, we've all done this. He was capable of sort of saying things that were then proved to be completely wrong 3 months, 6 months later, so especially some of the war predictions in the wartime commentaries broadcast on the BBC's Eastern Service. I mean, some of them do not pan out. But I mean, I've always found him a very reliable guide to the politics of the 1940s in terms of which side to trust, which was the authentic voice and which wasn't.
Well, the most valuable thing about him, and one of my favourite pieces by him, which doesn't normally get sort of anthologised, is this London letter he wrote for the Partisan Review in, I think, 1944, where he goes over his predictions earlier in the war, all the ones that were wrong, and just explains all the ways he was wrong and says, and why he was wrong. Like, was he going along with the consensus view? Was he being misled by his own biases? And he goes, I think it's really important to do this, to own up to where, you know, when we've been wrong, rather than just sort of retrofit it to make us look like we were actually right. And there are so many, if I look at the culture of newspaper columns now, essentially nobody does this. The whole thing is just to plough on regardless, and it doesn't matter if you're wrong.
That's right. He had that conversation with Tosco Fievel finally, didn't he, about Revenge is Sour, and Fievel pointed out to him that you're prejudiced about this and you don't realise it. And after that, he spent the last 5 years of his life trying to make amends for this. And if you look at the manuscript of 1984, he actually goes through it, taking out potentially anti-Semitic remarks.
Well, in terms of that kind of being able to see something you didn't see first, was the Spanish Civil War important as a sort of big instance of that for him? I mean, you know, going off to fight, dedicated anti-fascist, and suddenly turning around seeing what effectively his own side was turning into.
Oh, I think that to me is the crucial time, early 1937, when he was sort of going round literary London saying goodbye to people at the end of 1936, it really was all couched in terms of terrible things, great people, the Spanish, got to go out there and do something. And it took him until he got there. And he'd arrived, I think, with the intention of just writing some journalism at first. But it took, you know, revolutionary Barcelona to convince him that all this was worth fighting for. And then, as you say, within sort of 2 or 3 months, he began to see some of the imperfections, or rather some of the dissensions and the fissures in the side he'd fetched up on. But I mean, he went to Spain with knowing hardly anything of the situation, the background, who were the right people, who were the wrong, and had to sort of kind of make it up as he, I mean, his whole approach to the Spanish is incredibly rough and ready, you know, working things out as they were happening, I think.
I mean, that's what gives this a great sort of moral force, is that, again, it's like, well, if I believed that, that the fascists were uniquely bad and that the communists couldn't be that bad, then it's sort of my job to sort of point out to other people what I've seen. And then he starts sort of really trying to learn about totalitarianism. And so, again, it's almost like his strengths come from a very keen awareness of his weaknesses. It's like, how was I naive? How was I prejudiced? How was I wrong? And by sort of tackling that and trying to sort of think better, it's like Christopher Hitchens' line in Orwell, it says he doesn't teach you what to think, but how to think. And then he tries to convey that to readers, many of whom, obviously, as in the case of trying to tell people how bad Stalin was, they weren't particularly keen on hearing it.
I think, and he also tries to see it from the point of view of the ordinary person on the ground, which an awful lot of people weren't doing. I mean, one of the great points I think Orwell makes about the Spanish Civil War is the side you fought on largely depended on which part of Spain you lived in. And he actually says at one point that he could never make a case for fascism, but he thought that many individual fascists actually had a point in the context of the Spain in which they lived, which is an extraordinary thing for a left-wing democratic socialist who'd been shot through the throat by a fascist sniper to say after he'd come home.
But that was the part of the contrarian bit, wasn't it? When he's writing about Hitler, he's sort of going, he's sort of perversely...
Never brought, been able to bring myself to hate him. That's right. Never. I must put it on record, he says.
And then writing about Gandhi going, oh, you know, even though he's a good man, I never really liked Gandhi, you know. And so there was this sort of, I think a good kind of contrarianism rather than the sort of cheap grifter style, but a genuinely like, in order to sort of keep things interesting, it's like anybody can say how awful Hitler is. That's a given. But let's try and understand why people are drawn to him. And he reviewed loads of books about Nazi Germany. And he's just going, but you read these and you can't understand how anyone would support such a regime. And he says, I'm looking for somebody to explain to me why Hitler is actually popular if he's so awful. And so he's always kind of just trying to find the next thought. You know, the bit that sort of goes beyond received wisdom without just being a kind of, you know, cheap provocateur.
So do you think if he were alive today, he'd be trying to find what's attractive about the Kew Shaman or Baked Alaska surging into the Capitol?
He'd be asking why. I think he'd always be asking why. He goes, what motivates them? I don't think he'd be a fan. I don't think he'd be QAnon believer.
Excellent. Well, I think unfortunately we're running out of time, but thank you both very much indeed. Dorian Lynskey, DJ Taylor. Listeners, go out and buy these men's books and then all those Orwell reissues. Thanks very much, both.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, we very much hope that you'll subscribe on your podcast provider of choice and or rate and review us. Well, especially if you liked it. If you hated it, don't feel you have to review it. And equally, if there's something that you wanted to ask us about, something you think we could do better or something you enjoyed, please do send us your feedback to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks again for listening, and please join us for our next episode.